Nathan, great to have you here. So you're a host of this fantastic podcast, The Cognitive Revolution. I wanted to ask, first of all, why did you choose to name it The Cognitive Revolution? And yeah, what inspired you exactly to kind of start this project a couple of years ago?
So first of all, thank you for having me. Great to meet you and be here. I think, like previous revolutions that kind of changed everything, I think the AI revolution will change a lot of things. I'm not a big analogy guy generally, but one kind of really zoomed out analogy that I sometimes make is, prior to the Industrial Revolution, we basically had to use muscles to do physical work in the world. And, you know, that was what we had. So that's what we made do with. And then we invented a whole set of machines, you know, obviously a vast economy now powered by machines. And we no longer have to use our muscles for that. So we found other things to do. And I think the same thing is about to happen again, basically, where there is now something that obviously has very idiosyncratic strengths and weaknesses as compared to the human brain, but can do a lot of the same things that the human brain can do from a cognitive perspective. And so I think we're kind of on the brink of a revolution in how cognitive tasks and cognitive work generally get done. I think this is obviously going to be super disruptive and hopefully in a good way, but probably a mix, potentially in a really bad way. I think from my perspective, you know, a very wide range of possibilities are on the table for exactly how this goes. But I think the one thing that seems safe to bet on is a high rate of change in the next few years. And, you know, the name and the motivation, I think, are pretty much the same. Like, I saw this kind of coming. I happened to be in a position where I had early access to GPT-4 and was so blown away by my first interactions with it that I ended up dropping basically everything else I was doing at the time to spend 2 months full time just trying to figure out what I could understand about this GPT-4 system. This was 6 months before it launched to the public. And I was kind of like, you know, anything I can do to understand this stuff better and anything I can do to help other people understand it better and start to get prepared. I don't think we're going to be fully prepared for this. It's coming at us fast. But anything I can do to help, you know, society at large start to wrap their heads around and start to get prepared for what is coming, you know, seems like one of the most valuable contributions I could make.
Was there a reason that you chose to do this as opposed to kind of get involved directly in kind of AI or AI safety research yourself?
If you go too long without logging hours, you know, in direct contact with the latest AIs, and if you're not actively building things, then I think it is really easy to just sort of lose yourself and get caught up in the hype. And, you know, you're just, at some point, you're just repeating what other people have said. So it is really important to me to stay grounded. And I try to do that in a number of different ways. I do build stuff. You know, I started this company called Waymark, which is really how I got into this. Long story short, we used to be a DIY video creation software company for small businesses. And now we are a done-for-you by AI video creation software company. So that transition from DIY to done-for-you by AI, I think, is coming to a lot of things. Again, that's the cognitive revolution. We were early on that because the creative content creation type of stuff that we were doing just happened to be one of the first use cases that the AIs could actually do a good job with. So, you know, I came to this all from a very builder perspective. And I do think it's really critical to maintain that. And I am really interested in hands-on AI safety work as well. There's obviously a lot of different flavors of that. I'm interested in kind of red teaming, testing. I'm interested in interpretability. I don't think I'm particularly well suited to do interpretability at the highest level. So that's one reason I haven't gone deeper into that. I think if I had the right skill set, maybe I would have. But I do also see a need for somebody to try to maintain this zoomed out perspective. You know, when I talk to all these people on the show, it's very much like, you know, they're deep on their subject, right? And they might be an entrepreneur that's building a company. They might be a researcher that's, you know, building a technique, whatever it is that they're doing. People are typically deep down their own specific rabbit holes, and not too many people seem to have the inclination or perhaps the opportunity to have this sort of zoomed out view. So I kind of identified that as something that seemed like it was in relatively short supply. And anticipating that this was going to be something that was going to kind of touch everything, I thought, geez, you know, who's going to, how are we going to get ahead of the curve if everybody's, because I think a lot of, one big mistake I see in reasoning about AI and the AI future generally is most people sort of take the world as like roughly static. And then they're like, I'll apply AI here in my particular niche. And then we'll have sort of the world with AI in my niche. And that'll be like the future is the world mostly as it is today with, you know, a little application of AI here that I'm doing. And I think what is not well understood is that because this is happening everywhere simultaneously, one of my AI mantras is everything, everywhere, all at once. We're not, you know, we're in that process of kind of placing this new layer of AI enablement over everything. But what's on the other side of that, I think might just be like qualitatively different. You know, AI agents, for example, is kind of a great instance of this where people are sort of like, okay, what if I had an AI agent that can go out and do stuff for me? But I think what is coming quite soon is that everybody's going to have their AI agents. They're all going to be going out and trying to do stuff. And then they're going to be interacting with each other, or they're just going to be sort of creating like unexpected new dynamics. And I don't feel like I always say my crystal ball gets real foggy more than a couple months out. But I do think that is at least like really important to try to get a handle on. And so, you know, it seems like few people are doing that. So I figured I would try.
If you were to imagine, you know, hosting a podcast episode a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, and the kind of some of the most significant conversations that you may have at 1, 2, and 3 years away, what could you imagine you may be speaking to guests on the podcast about?
Well, it does get really hard to anticipate if you take the forecasts of the leading AI developers seriously, which I do. You know, they're all saying that AGI or powerful AI or transformative AI, depending on, you know, what phrase they specifically like to use, is coming soon. At a minimum, that seems to mean that we should have AIs that are kind of competent knowledge workers, you know, that could do like a lot of jobs in the economy. It might even mean that we have like Nobel Prize winning AIs, or, you know, Nobel Prize winning level AIs. And, you know, it might even mean we have super intelligence, whatever that means. So I think one of the challenges that I'm already feeling quite acutely is that, and this has just happened just over the last 2 years, right? So you don't have, if you just extrapolate another 2 years, it could get really extreme. But just speaking about what exists today and how it's evolved over the last 2 years, it's gone from something where I, as a like pretty well-rounded, you know, flatter myself to say reasonably smart person, could basically look at what the AI was doing across a wide range of domains and like have a pretty good sense for, is this real? Is it not real? Is it garbage? You know, is it hallucinating? It wasn't always easy to tell with GPT-4, but I felt like I could manage it. You know, it was possible for me to, just through individual interaction with GPT-4, like get a handle on what it could do, the original version 2 years ago. Now, especially with like the latest stuff from OpenAI, the O1s, the O1 Pros, the O3 series of models, and some of these latest benchmarks, you know, are really becoming tasks that are beyond what I understand and what I can evaluate. This is happening in math. You know, Frontier Math is a recently introduced benchmark that OpenAI's O3 made a pretty dramatic and I'd say quite unexpected leap in performance on. It's also happening a lot in science. So, you know, 2 years ago, you could have a chat with an AI, but it couldn't really do science for you in a meaningful way. Today, we see both AI agent type systems that are starting to do meaningful science. And we're also seeing these specialist models, things that are trained on DNA sequences, that are trained on, you know, protein structures, even things that are just trained on like low-level molecular simulations. And they're starting to do things where it's like, man, I have a lot of catching up to do just to even understand what the problem is that they're trying to solve, you know, let alone like how this thing works and, you know, is its contribution, you know, actually meaningfully advancing our understanding. So I just think we're getting to these frontiers. Frontier Math is probably the best example. Almost everyone you know would score a zero on Frontier Math. Like, I don't even really know what the questions are asking a lot of the time. The previous generation of, you know, until this O3 advance, the latest AIs got 2% at best. And then the leap was to 25%. So these things are now doing 25% of these math problems that math professors were specifically asked, you know, give us your really hard problems, the ones that like your students can't do, you can do, but, you know, they are not easy at all. And all of a sudden, you know, they're starting to break through on all these benchmarks. So it just seems like we're headed for this world of like greater and greater specialization, deeper and deeper expertise, more and more esoteric, not to say less important, because, you know, some of this stuff, understanding how like proteins work in cells, I mean, that's really important and potentially, you know, very consequential for changing the quality of life. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that leads to new medicines, right? So it's becoming more important, more impactful, but less accessible, and just a lot more work to even try to figure out like, what is it even talking about? You know, what's going on in this domain? So I feel like the last 6 months I've been doing a crash course on biology broadly, and that's not nearly enough to learn biology. Fortunately, I do have the AIs that can help me learn and catch up faster, definitely a lot faster than I otherwise would. But I'm still feeling like, man, I'm constantly underwater, and you know, I'm just struggling to kind of be conversant in all these, you know, biological questions that the AIs are well ahead of me on. And I think that probably continues, and we end up in a spot where very few people have the expertise to meaningfully evaluate what an AI is doing in any given domain. And then perhaps it even just kind of gets away from us. This is obviously one of the big fears, is that like, what happens when we can no longer evaluate what an AI is doing and determine if it's doing a good job or not? You know, how do we know if we can trust it? You know, and there's obviously a lot of different dimensions to what it means to trust an AI too. So yeah, my best guess is that we're headed for harder and harder time making sense of what is going on with AIs, even as they become more central, more impactful, and we rely on them more and more.
So not many people are a podcast host as their primary profession. I'm intrigued what it's like for you. What do you get up to exactly day to day, week to week? How do you prepare for episodes? How do you pick guests? How do you spend your time exactly?
Arguably, my position is even a little bit more unusual than that, in that I don't really think of myself as a content person. My North Star is just having the most accurate and up-to-date worldview possible. And to do that, I need to be constantly learning. So on a given day, you know, I'm always trying to ask myself, am I learning a lot right now? And if so, you know, that's great. And it could be from a wide range of activities. When I have a guest, you know, who's put out a paper, I read the paper. If it's somebody who, you know, has started a company and they've got a product, I use the product. So I really try to go, you know, briefly down all these different rabbit holes, learn what I can, and then try to move on pretty quickly. But I do think it is, I don't take this for granted at all. I think it's like extremely fortunate position to be in that. And I give all the credit basically to the subject matter. I don't really think I'm honestly that charismatic or like that great as an interviewer. I wouldn't expect to have much success if I was just like trying to host the Nathan, you know, Explains It All show. But there is incredible demand out there to understand what's going on in AI. So, you know, for all my deficits as a communicator, the subject matter, I think, is really carrying the podcast, because people just do have a real burning curiosity, or at least enough people do. So, you know, I'm fortunate in the sense that I don't really think much about the audience. I don't really think much about like what will be viral. I don't really think much about, you know, we've honestly been sort of almost stubbornly low production. You know, I just have this like white thing behind me, and I finally just upgraded my mic to a good quality mic, but you know, even the audio wasn't super great for a long time. And I just had the true north of, if I'm learning a lot from this, that's good enough for me. And it's sort of, you know, a happy kind of surprising fact about the world that like enough people are willing to do the work. When I meet people socially, you know, it'll often come up, oh, he's got an AI podcast. I always disclaim it. Warning, it's not entertainment. you know, it's like you're kind of signing up for like something like a lecture. I mean, it's a dialogue, but it's like, you know, it's pretty in the weeds. I ask a lot of like very detailed, nitty gritty follow-up questions that like most podcasts wouldn't ask, and that I wouldn't ask if I was trying to say like, what would make the most compelling hour of content? You know, I would do it very differently, but I genuinely am just trying to make sure that I come out of that conversation with the best understanding that I can achieve. And so sometimes it gets like pretty tedious, I feel. But I've just kind of decided, you know, whatever that leads to is fine. My goal is learning, and you know, this will be for the small subset of people that, you know, are just really interested in learning. And I totally, you know, people absolutely like pick and choose episodes. I try to come at it from like a lot of different angles. That's one other thing that I think I really love about studying AI in particular. And you can definitely see the, you know, if people check out the feed, you'll see it's kind of schizophrenic in that it's like, you know, sometimes it's very applied, hands-on, you know, how to make things work. Sometimes it's like extremely philosophical and sort of far out. We've done episodes on the possibility of AI consciousness, for example, which, you know, I really don't know what to make of. But I do think it's a question worth asking. We've done things on like safety, loss of control, deception, you know, some things on just like, how does a GPU work? It's very sort of all over the place. But I love that about it, because it does afford me the privilege of just kind of pivoting anytime I'm getting tired of something. You know, if I feel I'm like not learning as much, or if I'm just getting burned out, or if it's like bumming me out, you know, some of these like safety things, if you spend too much time in them, I do think they can kind of bum you out. So it's always good to just have a new, fresh approach. And AI certainly permits that. My calendar is honestly very clear. Sometimes I take a screenshot of my calendar and share it with someone, and it's like remarkably open. Not all days, but most days, I've got a pretty good block of time where I can just say, what do I want to understand better? You know, what's kind of bugging me that I feel like I have an unanswered question that's kind of in the back of my mind that I want to address, and then just try to figure out a way to go address it. Read, play, you know, it's also a technology that rewards play more than probably any other ever created, you know, just messing around, goofing around, trying silly stuff with AI tools is like, in and of itself, you know, can be a good way to learn.
I'm intrigued. Have you always been such like a curious, knowledge seeking person? Maybe you can tell us a bit more what you liked when you were younger and how you got to here. I believe you, as you mentioned kind of before this, you did some work at Waymark, and I think you did chemistry at Harvard University. But yeah, what were you like as a child, and how did that kind of shape who you are and where you got to now? Like, how would you explain the story of how you've become the podcaster or the researcher is a better way of maybe putting it, as you said?
I would say to my younger self, like, you're too much of a perfectionist. You're too concerned with like your grades, even up through college. You know, I was probably too concerned with like having a good, you know, transcript, and I should have been more willing to just follow curiosity and do things that, you know, maybe I was going to fail at. I would say I was for a lot of my life kind of afraid of failure, and, you know, it was a high achiever, but like kind of a strategic high achiever where I would, you know, not take the hardest math classes that were available, for example, as an undergrad, because I wasn't sure if I would do well in them. And in retrospect, you know, it's like, geez, never would have had a better opportunity, you know, to learn some of that stuff than then and there. And I let the fear of like maybe getting a B, you know, kind of deter me from it. That's like, doesn't make a lot of sense. Entrepreneurship, I think, kind of cured me of that, in as much as you're going to get no's, you're going to have failures, you're going to have, you know, customers that don't want to buy, investors that don't want to invest. So it definitely kind of got me comfortable with the reality that I was just not going to have like a clean sheet, you know, of 100% wins. I think that was definitely, you know, it was a process over years of, you know, running into all sorts of different challenges and not necessarily being able to solve them all, and having to kind of get creative and come at things from time to time from different angles. And I definitely think also just the GPT-4 moment was a switch where, you know, at Waymark, we had already been early adopters of GPT-3. We were fine tuning it. We had a case study on the OpenAI website because we were even such a small company, you know, going back just to 2022, their revenue was just like single digit, maybe into low double digit millions of dollars, you know, not a lot, right? So a small company like us that was just spending a few $1,000s a month, but doing a decent job with the product implementation, like that was enough to get a case study page on their website. These days, you know, it's been a long time since they've put, you know, a company as small as us on their site. So it's changed dramatically. But the point was I was already quite plugged in to the GPT-3 stage. And then we got this invitation to test GPT-4 initially just as a customer. It was called just a customer preview. They were like, hey, we got this new model. It's quite a bit better. You should try it out. The only advice they gave us was like, don't limit yourself to what you've tried before. Be open-minded and try more advanced things, more challenging things. Like you might be surprised by what this model can do. And I was just, it was like one of these moments that I'll never forget. They sent that email, by the way, late at night. I was, they're on the West Coast. I'm in Eastern time. So it was even later for me. I was like already in bed, but, oh, got this email. Oh, what's this? Check it out. And I was just like, okay, I'm not going to sleep for a while. This is insane. You know, the delta, the leap in what it could do was so striking, even to somebody who was already, you know, very well aware of what their previous generation could do, that I was just like, man, this is an all hands on deck situation. I asked them if they had a safety review process for that model, which they did. And then I asked them if I could join it, which they allowed me to do. And that's when I just kind of dropped everything else and felt like, not many people have the opportunity right now to look at this. It seems like probably the most important thing going on in the world. And, you know, a little bit of like a heroic narrative or whatever, I guess. I don't fall into that typically too badly, but it did feel more than probably any other moment in my life, like a certain duty, you know, like I just happen to be in this situation. I sometimes call myself the Forrest Gump of AI because I kind of keep finding myself in these like moments where I'm not the main character, but I'm sort of like this extra in like these important scenes. I definitely think of the GPT-4 thing that way. You know, I didn't make it, but I just all of a sudden found myself using it. And I was like, whoa. I felt a certain duty to like use that time and that access to the fullest, you know, of my personal ability. And I guess I've kind of not looked back since then. So it's funny, I'm working this out in real time. I don't spend a lot of time like narrativizing myself, but I'd say my young self was like a high achiever, but too strategic, not willing to take enough risks, too concerned with, you know, having straight A's, whatever. My entrepreneurship self kind of got cured of that, but it wasn't until this AI moment that I was like, oh, I need to really show up and do my best because, you know, the world at large kind of needs it. I felt that acutely in that testing phase, but I've kind of just maintained that because it does seem like the future could get really weird and we are definitely not prepared for it. So just kind of trying to contribute my small amount to what I see as kind of not even just civilizational, but like literally species wide challenge of getting prepared for and hopefully successfully adopting this technology. You know, that's an all hands on deck moment. And at least so far, you know, the fire has kind of stayed lit under my seat to keep me motivated.
Just speaking to perhaps more on the kind of AI safety side of the field quite a bit and all of the kind of general learning that you're doing about AI and keeping up to date with all the news and the advancements and maybe some of the more concerns. All of this, what impact does this have on you? Are you someone who's quite just excited and curious, so curious about it that doesn't do much, or does any of this ever kind of stress you out and concern you sometimes?
Pretty even keeled by default, but And certainly entrepreneurship, you know, will teach you through ups and downs and, you know, whatever that despite stress, you know, sometimes you just got to keep going. I'm really enthusiastic about what AI can do for me on a day in and day out basis. I am easily, like regularly, a multiple more productive. You know, if I'm trying to code something, I was never a great coder. I can now move way faster with AI. With writing, you know, I always kind of consider myself to be a pretty good writer, but very slow and too precious. Getting AI help in my writing process, you know, dramatically accelerates how much I can create while still feeling like I'm, you know, doing a good job of hitting the quality bar that I want to hit. So in my personal life, it's like awesome, you know, and I ask it questions. I use it to learn. You know, it's been instrumental, as I mentioned, in trying to catch up with biology. So I'm like very naturally and sincerely enthused about the technology, what it can do. It's also just fascinating that like, geez, we've created another form of intelligence. Like that's, you know, that in and of itself is like, you know, kind of a can't look away sort of phenomenon. And at the same time, I definitely feel like, yikes, you know, we don't really understand how these things work very well. We don't have any reliable means to control them. And I think they are safe today, really only because they're not that powerful. I do sleep pretty well at night still. I kind of feel like, you know, this is all way bigger than me, certainly. I'm not like a key decision maker. At most, I'm going to, you know, make a small nudge to the overall course of history. And even that would be like a lot to expect. So I kind of just ride the like positivity and curiosity and try to make sure that the sort of fear side is like not entirely neglected and communicate that to other people. Cause I do think it is important. Sometimes I boil all that down to describing myself as an adoption accelerationist, hyperscaling pauser. Accelerationist in the AI discourse is like somebody who's like, you know, don't worry about anything. Just keep scaling, keep driving, keep making these things more powerful. It'll all be fine. Adoption accelerationist is my twist on it, which is like, we should all be taking the absolute most advantage we can of this technology for just mundane reasons, right? Day-to-day productivity, you know, do your work faster, spend more time with your family. Like there's just a better life, you know, immediately available to people who figure out how to use AI well. And so I want to see everybody get that benefit. And I also kind of think that if more people had a good understanding of where we are, then they would also be like much more inclined to be kind of, in my mind, like healthily fearful of what might come next. I think it's very hard for people to even wrap their heads around this, you know, possible big picture downside if they haven't even seen, you know, that this thing can like code effectively, right? So I try to push the positive side, ride that, you know, don't deny the upside. I think that's another thing that, you know, sometimes the safety folks want to kind of dismiss the upside. And I think that just ends up with like lost credibility. Cause from my standpoint, the upside is undeniable. But yeah, I sort of have this like parallel track or sort of, you know, different, mindsets, and I wouldn't necessarily recommend it for everybody. I personally don't find it to be that hard to manage, or I'm not like too bummed out about it. But if somebody were to say like, hey, I tried kind of inhabiting that same mind space and it's just not working well for me, I wouldn't say they're wrong. You know, I wouldn't say they, maybe they should do something else. I don't know. I don't have a great answer to that. All I can say is, I guess for me, it doesn't bum me out too much, even though it does feel like something that kind of is like hair raising, and kind of, you know, kind of scary, but I don't find it like too hard to function. And I don't really have a great explanation as to why I'm not like more consumed, you know, by the fear, because I think it is very real. I'm not like, I'm not dismissing it at all. It's just that, I guess, you know, accident of my personal constitution or whatever, you know, is I seem to be able to kind of compartmentalize.
As someone who gets to speak to so many people in the field, I'm kind of intrigued if you've like spotted this, a couple kind of patterns. So one thing is, are there any kind of significant beliefs that you are spotting many people in the field hold? And then in kind of on the contrary, are there anything that you most kind of, any other significant things that you see just so much disagreement between, any kind of commonalities or disagreements you think that are interesting to point out that you've observed from chatting to so many people?
I do think one of the most consequential intuitions that people have that can break very different ways is just this question of how powerful are the AIs going to get in the next few years. You have a very wide range of outlooks on that. I tend to think there's pretty good reason to expect that they're going to get very powerful, but you do hear, you know, I mean, it's as the capabilities continue to advance, like some of these, you know, people are starting to switch their outlooks, and some of these older arguments are like clearly sort of not holding water anymore. But you've heard a lot of things over the last couple of years, like, well, yeah, you could sort of scale up with all the internet data, but now we're out of internet data. So, you know, we're kind of at the end of that. And that may be true in the sense that there is no, you know, we've only got one internet. Yes, that doesn't necessarily mean the end of AI capabilities advancements. Another one is like, well, you know, they're going to be limited to learning what we know. Because these AIs are trained on, you know, the human body of knowledge as represented in text, they're going to learn everything that we know, but they're not going to learn anything we don't know. So we don't really have to worry about them kind of running away from us. They're going to be governed by what we know. I think that's, again, starting to become pretty hard to defend for multiple different reasons. I mean, the frontier math is a pretty good one. I don't know that we have test results yet from humans on, like, if we gave these frontier math questions to all the math professors that contributed the questions, like, what would their scores be? I suspect that the best AI, which is the O3 model from OpenAI, not yet released, but they announced this, I suspect that it is probably on the level of, if not beating, most of the math professors that contributed these questions. Because these are such niche, you know, far-flung, far-out questions that, like, again, all these people are in their own little subdomain, right? They're all deep down their one rabbit hole. And they can't necessarily solve the frontier math questions that, like, other professors submitted, right? So I think we're already at a level where they're starting to show meaningful signs of being superhuman. And you see this definitely in the biology as well, where humans, you know, just don't have an intuition for some of these domains. I mean, the protein folding problem is like the classic one, right? We know how to read the sequence of the DNA. We know what that translates to in terms of the individual amino acids that get joined together to make a protein. But then we didn't know, how does that actually work in practice? Like it folds up into some shape, and the actual shape, you know, these proteins are little machines, and the shape and the way that they move is like critical. I mean, it defines, you know, what they actually do physically in the living environment of the cell. But we previously had no way to translate that DNA sequence into an actual shape. Some like very expensive and slow experimental methods were used, but now we have AIs that can basically take a sequence and spit out one of those structures. And they're similarly accurate to our experimental methods. And I sort of interpret that as the AIs having the ability to learn an intuitive physics in essentially any space where there's a lot of data for them to learn from. And we just don't have that. You know, we don't have the ability, and no human, to my knowledge, has ever developed an intuition for, oh, kind of see that sequence of amino acids? Yeah, I kind of know what that's going to be. I don't think there's a single human alive that has that sort of intuition. And meanwhile, you know, we have these AIs that have that, not just in that space, but in, you know, an ever-growing number of different idiosyncratic spaces where people don't have intuition and the AIs are seemingly developing a sort of intuition. So I guess, you know, I think a lot of people just have not updated. They're not aware of all this information. That's, again, part of why I try to, you know, do what I'm trying to do is to have that very broad view and to be able to communicate like, hey, you should know what's going on over here. Together, this adds up to a picture that I think should update your worldview. Most people just haven't been exposed to all that information yet, haven't had a chance to do the update to their worldview. And so I think there's still a lot of just like, well, the AIs aren't going to get that strong. they're going to be limited by this, or they're going to be limited by that, or, you know, they're going to kind of, they're not going to get past our level. And so much falls out of that, right? If you think that an AI is going to get to, you know, an intern level and never get better, or if you think it's going to be sort of, okay, well, yeah, maybe it could go past intern level, but yeah, it's going to be sort of early PhD level, but that's kind of as far as it can go. Then I think you have a very different outlook for what's that going to mean for the economy? What does that mean for, like, what regulations, you know, or safety measures are really required to handle that power well? You know, a lot of things, if you don't believe the AIs are going to improve past a certain point, just a lot of other questions you don't really need to worry about. But if you do think they're going to go past that point, then, like, all those questions become very, very salient. And, you know, I hope to help people update their worldviews to a more accurate one. But for now, you know, I'd say that remains probably the biggest fault line that I see in the AI discourse is just, do you think we're kind of reaching a plateau that will be here for a long time and we can kind of manage it like we are and it'll be fine? Or do you see us kind of, do you see the AI sort of running away from us? In which case we have, like, you know, a lot of unanswered questions.
The final question, Nathan, a bit of a different one, which is, yeah, what do you think it means to live a good life?
Well, it's funny you say that, because I've sometimes recently said, my job is to figure out what's going on with AI, and it's somebody else's department to figure out what constitutes a good life. So I really, you know, aside from, like, very sort of run-of-the-mill, you know, normal things to say that are probably cliches, I don't really feel like I have great answers to that question. And I actually do think that is something that we probably need to be investing more in, because if the AI cognitive revolution goes well, we'll have, you know, sort of the old John Maynard Keynes question of, like, what do we want to do with our time, right? I mean, he famously predicted that we would be working like 15 hours a week at this point, and we're still working a lot. And there's obviously a lot of debate as to, you know, will there still be jobs? Or, you know, some people think we're always, even if there's super intelligence, we're always going to have human jobs. I really don't buy that. I think that it could very well be the case that humans are not very well able to contribute to the economy, if only because it's, like, potentially moving really fast, because AIs work really fast, and it's just hard for people to, like, keep up and integrate into that. If you imagine yourself being a person that, you know, were for whatever reason only able to move, think, talk, understand at 1% the speed of everybody around you, like, it would be hard to get a job. You know, people would be like, yeah, maybe you can do things, but, like, if it takes you 100 days to do what somebody else can do in a day, like, you're kind of not employable, because 100 days from now we're onto something else, you know. And it's like, yeah, you maybe could do that task, but on that time scale, it's just not useful to me. So I don't necessarily think we are going to have the same employment model. I don't think we should bank on, you know, we'll continue to get meaning from work to the degree that people feel like their meaning comes from work. But, you know, where's it going to come from? What does a good life of leisure look like? I honestly am looking for sources of inspiration there myself. And these days, you know, I'm honestly very normal, very kind of, my personal life is pretty boring. Like, I'm married, I have three kids, I live in Detroit, you know, in a house. It's a pretty day in, day out, just kind of normal existence, nothing too crazy. But I would suggest that more people make it their own personal strategy to try to kind of pioneer new ways of living that could amount to a good life, and kind of report back to us. Because I don't think I have a great answer that's going to, like, you know, apply in a few years.
Okay. Well, maybe the AIs will eventually help us work out the answer to that one. But Nathan, thanks so much. It's been super interesting and great to meet you. And yeah, thank you for putting out all this great content. Look forward to seeing what happens on your show over the next few years.
My pleasure, of course. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for watching this episode. If you enjoyed it, please consider hitting the subscribe button below. And I hope to see you here again.